Good morning. There's a scene in The Silver Chair where Jill is speaking with Aslan right at the beginning, but she does not yet realize who it is she's speaking to. She sees a lion who talks, and she's frightened of him, and she says to him, "Do you eat girls?" And he says, "I have swallowed up girls and boys, women and men, kings and emperors, cities and realms," said the lion. And our text today reminded me of this passage, and I hope that it will mean the same thing to you. We have in our minds, in our imaginations, this understanding, much of it from popular evangelical culture, of who Jesus is and what he is doing. But the scripture speaks of him as a King of kings and Lord of lords who serves his glorious bride in awesome judgments against her persecutors. And so, in that spirit, I would invite you to stand as we read a prophecy concerning this in Matthew chapter 24. We're going to begin in verse 15. So you're going to have to look there in the bulletin because it has the whole chapter 24 printed. Verse 15, hear God's holy word. "So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let the one who is on the housetop not go down to take what is in his house. And let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas, for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days, pray that your flight may not be in winter or on a Sabbath. For there will be a great tribulation, such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and never will be. And if those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Then if anyone says to you, 'Look, here is the Christ,' or 'There he is,' do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. So if they say to you, 'Look, he's in the wilderness,' do not go out. If they say, 'Look, he's in the inner rooms,' do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other." This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
You may be seated. I'm very mindful that we have many guests here today. At least there's a number of new faces, and we're in part three of a series on the Olivet Discourse. And some of you will only be here for this one message, so it might be a little bit confusing because I'm building on the argument of the previous two sermons. But I will review briefly what we've covered. So this is not, we're only spending 3 weeks here in chapters 23 and chapters 24. We're not going line by line through every element of the Olivet Discourse. There are really, really good books on the Olivet Discourse, some of them long and some of them short, that I would commend to you. Peter Lighthart, James Jordan, Ken Gentry, very, very helpful books, especially the Jim Jordan and Ken Gentry books are very short. They're just these brief readings of the Olivet Discourse. I'm sure that we have copies of them in our library, or we'll soon have them. Check them out. You can find them online. Very cheap. So if you want to go deeper, I would encourage you. There is talk of a men's group that is perhaps going to be reading Josephus' Jewish Wars as we go through the Revelation in this fall and winter. And if you haven't read Josephus' Jewish Wars, it's actually not a very, very long book. It's very helpful. It gives some insight into what it looked like from someone who was there. But we're not going line by line through this entire text. This is the whole purpose of these three sermons is to set up our understanding of how the Olivet Discourse, Jesus' prophecy, fits with the Revelation and how these two work together and sets them up. So 2 weeks ago, we read in chapter 23, Jesus' judgment against the Pharisees and scribes. And we examined a little bit about Pharisaism and what went wrong with the Pharisees. But mostly what I would have you to remember is that he ends his prophecy of judgment against them with this statement that all the blood from Abel to Zechariah would come on this generation. Would come on this generation. And he made it clear then that the temple was left desolate. And then he left the temple, it says. He walked away. And so that's very important if you're going to understand, because chapter 24, the disciples come to him and ask him about these things. When is this going to happen? And so we looked more closely at some of the reasons to believe, and this is what I want you to understand. It will not make much sense today, what I'm saying, if you don't understand this. That Jesus' discourse in Matthew 24, all this prophecy of judgment, was intended to describe what was coming on the generation that he was speaking to. That generation. He says this explicitly. Again, it's very similar language to what he said to the Pharisees. Verse 34, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Now, to reemphasize this, because again, I know that we have a lot of people who have not been there. Some people might be thinking, maybe they read in the MacArthur Study Bible, that this generation does not mean the generation he's speaking to, or it means something else. But Jesus has been speaking to this generation throughout the entire Gospel of Matthew. In chapter 11, but to what shall I compare this generation? It is like children sitting in the marketplace and calling to the playmates. We played the flute for you and you did not dance. We sang a dirge, you did not mourn. And so he speaks of them as not receiving the prophets that have come to them. They always have these tests that don't match up with what their expectations are. But anyway, it's a word of condemnation of this generation. And then just a few chapters later, or one chapter later, chapter 12, the men of Nineveh shall rise up in judgment with this generation and condemn it. For they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and behold, something greater than Jonah is here. The queen of the south will rise up in judgment with this generation and condemn it. For she came with the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and behold, something greater than Solomon is here. And again, just the next verse, he goes on. And this is a parable that he teaches about a demon. And I think we often remember this parable out of its context. We have to remember he's talking about the evils of this generation. It's what he's describing in the parable. When an unclean spirit goes out of a person, it passes through waterless places seeking rest but finds none. Then it says, I will return to my house from which I came. And when it goes, it finds the house empty, swept, and put in order. And that is referring to the fact that Jesus cleaned house in Israel, cast out demons out of legions of people. Then it goes, the demon, and brings with it seven other spirits, more evil than itself. And they enter and dwell there. And the last state of that person is worse than the first. And to be absolutely clear, he adds this, so also will it be with this evil generation. this evil generation is going to be so filled with demons sevenfold from what the condition that he found it, and he cleaned it up. But they've rejected their Messiah. These demons are coming back with all of their friends. In chapter 16, he speaks of an evil and adulterous generation that seeks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it except the sign of Jonah. And then the next chapter, speaking to this generation, O faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? But then, for some reason, we are led to believe by scholars and commentators that when we come to Jesus' two references to this generation in chapters 23 and 24, he's referring to some other people in another time. That is very strained. It's very strained. And honest commentators will acknowledge that. The natural way to read that would be the way the people that he has generation is. In the same manner, we come to the book of Revelation, the revelation of Jesus Christ. It says, the very beginning, not to steal thunder from Bo, just saying it's exactly the same expectation in the revelation, where it starts, which referring to the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave to show his servants the things that must soon take place. Blessed is the one who reads aloud the words of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear and who keep what is written in it, for the time is near. Seems to fit with exactly what he said in Matthew 24. It's all going to happen in this generation. At the end of the prophecy, it says, these words are trustworthy and true, and the Lord, the God of spirits of prophets, has sent his angel to show his servants what must soon take place. And so this is what we have called here, and we introduced a term, a preterist reading of these prophecies. It's the Latin word for past. It took place in the past. That's what it means. A preterist reading of these prophecies says that these prophecies were largely fulfilled in the past. There are elements, even within these prophecies and the words of Christ, that are still yet to come. We are not full preterists. Everything is in the past. Every prophecy is fulfilled. But these prophecies concern a great cataclysmic event that would come upon the generation that Christ was speaking to. And that is the interpretive assumption that Bo and I and the elders have regarding the prophecy of this prophecy and the revelation. Now, there is obviously, as you are well aware of, another way of reading these things. And it's more popular today. But interpretation is not simply a matter of counting heads. But it begins with the assumption that our text today and large portions of Revelation cannot be in the past. They could not have been fulfilled in the past because, they say, these things simply did not happen. They simply did not happen. And if they didn't happen, then they must be, because Jesus' words are true, and these are believing people that believe this. We're not calling that into question. They must be in our future. That's called a futurist reading of this text. And so for these people, the events of Matthew 24, what I just read there, specifically verses 15 to 31, what we just read there, that is determinative. Those things didn't happen. And they go on to the timing verses where Jesus says it's happening to this generation. And they say, well, it simply cannot mean the generation that was alive when he was speaking. It simply can't mean that. It must mean something else. So they play around with the word generation, or they play around with the word coming, or they play around with the word this. And they try to find other ways of thinking about those words. But as I said, that's simply they acknowledge themselves. It's a very strained way to read what Jesus is saying there. But we find those timing verses determinative. Jesus said this is happening in this generation. So when we come to the verses we're going to unpack a little bit today, verses 15 to 31, we say, well, this can't have been the very last event of human history, the very final resurrection, the very final step into glory, the glorification of all creation in flesh and final damnation, the great white throne judgment, the end of all things. This can't be referring to those things because we're still here. We're still here. We're not in our resurrected bodies. We are still sinning. We're not fully glorified. And that makes sense. But notice, this is what we don't say. Follow my logic here. We don't say, well, this can't be the parousia because Jesus hasn't come back yet. You see, we do believe Jesus came back. Okay? We have been so taught the second coming, a phrase that's not actually in Scripture, to think that it always only ever refers to one thing at the end of human history. And I would say that there is another way to read Matthew 24, Revelation 19, the vision of Jesus on the white horse, other than Jesus' literal coming to earth, physically to touch down on earth, resurrect all the dead, and to bring about the very end. And in fact, I believe that there's no reason to believe that Jesus has not come back in this sense many times to dispatch evildoers, to remove lampstands, to comfort the afflicted, to set his people free, and to meet with his people at his table. Because I understand this prophecy not to be a literal, something to be taken on the surface literally, woodenly, but a symbolic and apocalyptic prophecy. As it says in Revelation 19, speaking of Christ coming there, in righteousness he judges and makes war. From his mouth comes a sharp sword with which he strikes down the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron. You see, the image of Jesus there, that coming, that great cataclysmic event, coming in judgment, he is fighting. But he is not fighting with a broadsword. He is fighting with his tongue, with his edict, his power to proclaim and declare and dispatch angelic warriors and dispatch armies. The most lethal thing in the universe is the sword tongue of Christ. As it says there, the rest were slain by the sword that came from the mouth of him who was sitting on the horse, and all the birds were gorged with their flesh. Those were literal people who literally died, but they did not die with a flicker of a ninja sword coming out of Jesus' mouth. They came from his word. He is a warrior who fights a cosmic war, summons angels and armies to do his bidding. And that is exactly what we read as we're going to unfold in the Revelation. As he comes back to the harlot city, through the word of his mouth, he turns the beast against the harlot, as it says there. The harlot is devoured by the beast that she was riding upon. The Romans are the ones who execute his fierce wrath, as it says. And it is his fierce wrath that is seen that day, Revelation 19. He will tread the winepress of the fury of the wrath of God the Almighty. And so, coming back to, let's set aside Revelation a little bit. We're going to spend a lot of time there. But coming back to our text, we still have to deal with, well, what is this? What are all these elements? What is going on here? So I offer to you my reading of this text. And this interpretation is not without some difficulty, I admit. I will happily admit that there are men much more studied and insightful than myself who disagree with me. But through my study, reading men like that and other men, This is how Matthew 24, verses 15 to 31, the parousia of Christ, makes the most sense to me. So we'll just take this in elements at a time. First, the first six verses here, 15 to 20, speaks of this abomination of desolation and the fleeing. The fleeing. There's a lot of description about what they are to do in terms of fleeing, to get out of town. Okay? And as I mentioned last week, we touched on the abomination of desolation. It relates to not some Gentile person who just marches into the temple and tears things down. The abominations that are spoken of, it references back to Daniel, always connects to abominations that are introduced through the religious leadership of Israel. It is Jewish religious leadership and their covenantal unfaithfulness, their capitulation to Caesar, their persecution of the saints, their defiling of the temple proper. First through, think, exploitation in the time of Christ when he's flipping over tables. They're exploiting religious worship for financial gain. But later through violence, the cessation of morning and evening sacrifices and the purity offerings. Now remember, you also need to read Matthew side by side with Luke and Mark. And if you hop over to Luke, he places the occasion of their fleeing, not with the abomination of desolation, but for some reason, he points to, okay, this must have been in this lengthier speech of Christ, he points to the Roman armies surrounding Jerusalem. He doesn't mention the abomination of desolation at all. He says, when you see that, get out of town. Okay? So, somehow, these things are connected. And so we know that what he's referring to, the abomination of desolation and the armies surrounding, those are things that took place right at the very end, just a few years before. It could be read as the hostilities started in AD 66. They obviously culminated in AD 70. So there were a number of hostilities, skirmishes and battles and sieges that took place around Jerusalem and around Judea. But the actual siege of Jerusalem happened right at the end. So there's things that took place right there at the beginning. And we learn from historians that the chief priests at a certain time lost control of the temple complex. Herod Agrippa, so zealots, these are the men, by the way, Jesus described in chapter 23 as being the proselytes of the Pharisees and the scribes. And he says, and they're going to be twice the sons of hell that you are. Okay? So the zealotry increases to a fever pitch. We also would understand that, of course, these are going to be demon-possessed people. This is going to be charged with demonic anger and fury. As he said there earlier. So, the temple is lost to the zealots, this huge complex. If you could see a picture of what it looked like in the ancient world, it's dominated by this most massive structure. One of, if not the largest structure in the ancient world. Not the temple itself. It's roughly the same size as it was in Solomon, but the temple complex is this massive, massive structure. And the priests lost control to the zealots. So Herod Agrippa tried to quell the zealots with a force of soldiers, and he brought in cavalry, but he was forced to withdraw. And the temple compound was left in the hands of murderous zealots who began to kill the troops that were loyal to Agrippa. So this is Jews killing Jews in the temple structure itself. Assassins also, they killed Herod's troop. They began to burn down several buildings. And then they turned their fury on the Roman soldiers that were stationed there. They burned a number of buildings. They burned, by the way, one of the buildings where the debts had been recorded. If you were part of the men's group a while back, we read that book. What is it called? It was about the massive amounts of economic injustice that was taking place through the religious leadership at that time. There was tremendous debt among the people during that time. That was one of the first buildings they burned down to the ground. But then they turn their fury against the Roman fortress. They attack it's called the Antonia fortress. And then they began to gather weapons. It's like, this is it. This is it. We're going to, they thought, kick Rome out once and for all. The temple complex from this time on basically became a fortress of zealots. And the temple is the most defensible place in the position. Mount Zion is actually slightly higher, and Herod had a palace up there. But the temple, the walls of the temple and the structures itself make defending the temple the most, it's the most like a fortress in the city. It would be the last place taken by the Romans as they make their way from section to section in the city. This great structure of worship also so it would function as their fort. And for this reason, various groups of zealots and parties would vie for control over the temple in the next couple of years. And I believe that it is during this time that any Christians living in Rome or the surrounding area would have recognized this is it. This is it. The temple is overrun with faithless covenant breakers. They're not keeping the sacrifices. They're not honoring the temple. And the Romans are furious, and they are coming to wipe us off the map. And that fulfills both the qualifications there. And here's a further description, if you're still in doubt, from Josephus that I find stunning of what it looked like during this time in the temple itself. It says, Josephus says, the zealots had taken refuge in the temple of God and turned it into a fortress, making the holy place their headquarters. They pretended that, according to the ancient law, the high priest should be chosen by lot, although the succession was hereditary. Casting lots, the office fell on a coarse clown named Fanni, who scarcely knew what the high priesthood meant. Yet they dressed him in the sacred vestments and taught him how to act. This shocking impiety, which was to them a subject of merriment, drew tears from the other priests, and they grieved over this mockery of their law. And many of the Jews outside were zealous of their own. See, what charged the people that had taken the compound, the temple, was the hatred of Rome, largely. They'd lost that spirit of Pharisaical, the older Hasidim spirit of obedience and careful obedience to the law, and it just became a hatred of the Gentiles. But the other Jews were having none of this, and they became furious. They began to attack the zealots during this time. Romans, by this point, have stationed soldiers all around the city, and the Jews attacked the zealots in the temple. But the zealots locked themselves up inside the temple itself. And seeing the dead bodies gather all around and throughout the temple, they withdrew. They withdrew. And so they're locked up in the temple. There's all these dead bodies in the temple. They're surrounded. The Romans have surrounded them. And who shows up except a bunch of 20,000 Edomians? These are descendants of Edomites, who want to get involved in this because they see an opportunity for vengeance and loot and plunder. And they arrive after some dispute. They decide to side with the zealots and to turn against the people themselves. They killed the recognized high priest and his son, one Ananias, and Jesus was the name of the high priest at that time. Ananias, the high priest, and his son Jesus. They killed at that time 12,000 people in the city. And after many atrocities, the Idumeans began to regret joining the zealots on account of their barbarism. So these are like mercenaries that show up. They side with the zealots, and they're fighting against the Jews. And they're watching the zealots kill people indiscriminately. And they're like, you guys are crazy. You have lost your minds. And I believe that what you're looking at, if you had been an onlooker during this time, would have been a clear act of defilement of the holy places. They would have recognized it as the worst of abominations. You see, it wasn't, they did not set up idols inside there. They weren't sodomites or committing immorality or doing something. It was a murderous, demonic zeal that Jesus noted 40 years before this time. That was the fruit of the Pharisees and scribes' teaching. And they would trample holy things in their hatred of the Gentiles. Jesus says to them, get out of town when you see that happening. And so the next event in our Lord's prophetic timeline is the Great Tribulation. Now, this is often portrayed by contemporary prophecy experts as a time of great cosmic and demonic chaos, and certainly was that. But I would just note that from Jesus' standpoint, and I want you to think about this and let it sink in, it is something that you can run away from on foot. The Great Tribulation is something that you need to get out of there quickly, but you can get out of there. You can get out of there on foot. You're going to be traveling on foot. Pray that your flight would not be on a Sabbath or in the winter. But get out of there. Now, others have noticed from Jesus' own language here, and speaking of the greatness of this tribulation, that it cannot have referred to what happened in the first century, because we now know of greater tribulations, they say. How could it possibly have been fulfilled in the first century when we know of things happening after that, like the Black Plague and the Holocaust? He says, Jesus says, such has not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and never will be. Now, God forbid I make light of the Holocaust. It's not my intention, or the Black Plague, or anything like that. But I do want to add a few thoughts to this. A few thoughts to maybe can help you to understand what he's referring to here when he speaks like this. The covenantal curses of Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28 describe not merely death and suffering, but great psychological torment from God himself. It would not be that he would simply covenantally put these people to death, but he would also torment them and trouble them. And I know we've spoken about this before as we've gone through the prophets and spoken of the, remember Jeremiah spoke of the madness that would come upon these people, the madness. The madness was an affliction that God gave to his covenant hardened covenant breakers. And it seems clear to me that the tribulation, which did result in many, many people dying, but also would have been given a special covenantal fear and trouble of spirit and affliction during this time, and being handed over to the torment of demons. So that's one thing to consider. It simply can't mean the total, it can't mean the total number of people who die during this tribulation would be greater than anything else in human history. Undoubtedly, more people died in the flood than in the tribulations we've mentioned so far. And so I don't think it's simply a matter of how many people die. Because for one thing, Jesus says it's not going to consume every single human being that is living here. It's going to be cut short. Now, if it had been allowed to continue, then there would be no human life in that place left. But it would be cut short. So it's not a total annihilation. But I also want you to note that it is something that Jesus says you could flee from on foot. So what do we see as we look at, again, historians, we look at what happened in Jerusalem around that time period, we see a great tribulation that actually took place. In the remaining years of the 60s, from the abomination of desolation up to the destruction of Jerusalem, this was a period of great chaos, murder, starvation, betrayal, fanaticism, and suffering. Suffering. And I believe that is the tribulation that Jesus had in mind. And I want to read a few examples of the kinds of tribulations that took place during this period. In Damascus during the Jewish War, the people, so this is outside of Judea, up in Syria, the people of the city gathered up all the Jews and put them in a gymnasium, 10,500 people. They did not trust them. It was like putting them in a kind of like a concentration camp. okay? Because they're watching this unfold down in Judea. They don't trust these people. When they saw that they attacked the Romans, they went into the gymnasium and slaughtered every single person in there. In the siege of Jotapata, which is where Josephus himself was a general fighting for the Jews, 1,200 Jewish women and children were taken alive into slavery. Every other inhabitant of the town, except for Josephus, he was allowed to tell the tale, was slaughtered. The town was razed to the ground. Over 40,000 people died. In describing the end of the conflict, the end of the conflict in Jerusalem, Josephus writes the following. The total number of prisoners taken during the war was almost 100,000 people. And those who died during the siege, he gives this number, 1,100,000 people. The greater part of these were of Jewish blood, but not natives of the city. Because just before the siege, people had flocked into Jerusalem from all parts of the country for the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Remember, all the people of Israel that could had to come and visit three times a year. They tied. So you have this mass migration of people that would come to Jerusalem. Jerusalem had been specially designed. The whole infrastructure was designed to accommodate tons and tons and tons of visitors. And so at that given time, there was, according to Josephus, over a million people in the city. Over a million people in the city. Tacitus, a Roman historian who knew about these things from a distance, but he knew about these things, he put the actual number at 600,000 people. But we don't know for sure. Josephus was actually there as a witness. He was there in Vespasian's company. Observing this, but Tacitus had heard from the number to be 600,000. But whatever the sense is, I just want you to understand that this is a very small space. It's roughly a mile wide, just over a mile wide at its largest point, and a half mile wide at its shortest point. Put a million people inside that area, lock them up for months, turn them on each other, starvation, suffering, projectiles over the walls, burning, looting, pillaging, murderous, adds some Idumean. This was a horrific, horrific event. Now, in the next couple of verses, I just want to add this. This is one of the great afflictions of human history. We don't, for some reason in our history books, pay much attention to it. Pay much attention to it. And that's unfortunate. Not just because of we Christians and readers of the Bible have a lot of reason to pay much attention to it. Covenantally, what is taking place, cosmically, what is taking place during this time, there's much reason to pay attention to it. But even in terms of just history, world history, this was a major turning point. Now, in the next few verses, Jesus warns his disciples about being led astray, thinking that they might miss his coming, his parousia. And so in these verses, he warns them not to be deceived by people claiming he has already come. Do not follow anyone's advice like, oh, he's over there in the wilderness. Let's go out to him. Or he's in this building. We got to come in to him. He says it's not going to be like that. Okay? He says, for the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will the coming of the Son of Man be. And then he says, wherever the corpse is, there the eagles will gather. Now, some people point to the cosmic, heavenly nature of the lightning, something flashing across the sky. You can see it wherever you stand. You might be miles away in that direction. You see a flash of light. Or miles over here, you see a flash of light. So he says, they understand that to mean that this is going to be some great cosmic display in the sky, okay? And I'll let that stand. I think that that's fine. But I would note that he literally says here that his parousia would be gathered among corpses. Where is the corpse? You're not going to miss it. Look for the dead bodies. Look for the dead bodies. And so my reading of this is that you are not to be led astray by thinking, okay, you know, it happened actually out in the wilderness. It's like over by Petra. We need to like run over in that direction. A Christian is saying, no, where are all the dead bodies going to be? That's his coming. Because that's what he's coming back to do. In other words, if you want to see him, look for corpses. I know of no other way to understand this. But within one generation, a million corpses would pile up inside the large city of Jerusalem after many abominable acts by the Jews in the city and the temple. The Romans would surround it with their eagle banners. It's the same word. In our translations, always translated vultures. It's just the normal word for eagles. Now, they can refer to a species of vulture, but isn't it significant that what they would have seen all the way around the outside of the city are eagle banners? I think that's not a coincidence. The Romans would surround it, and I can't even imagine what it would have meant to have that many dead bodies in that small of a space. It is one of the great horrors of the ancient world. Wherever the corpse is, there the eagles will gather. And that's where the parousia of Christ is going to happen. And that's how you will know that it happened. But we go on. Verse 29, he speaks of a shakeup in the heavens. The Lord describes his parousia with a long sentence here. Okay? This is all one sentence joined by the word chi. It's just repeated. And this will happen, and this will happen, and this, and this, and this, and this, and this, and this. Okay? It's just a figure of speech called polysyndeton to make it more dramatic. But it basically refers to one great sequence of events that's going to happen at once. Now, it's interesting, as I mentioned last week, there's no more talk of armies or anything like that. Everything is now cast in terms of its cosmic significance, okay? And the redemption of the saints. It's looked at from that perspective. And so I'm going to read it as I think it should be translated here. So follow along with me. Now, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken, and then will appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then all the tribes of the land will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory, and he will send out his angels and gather with a great trumpet call, and will gather his elect with four winds, and the ends of the earth and the ends of heaven to the ends of them. And it is that at that point that I think that we would agree many modern Christians will simply say, well, that surely didn't happen in AD 70. Whatever did happen in AD 70, as horrific as it wasn't this. Jesus didn't come in the sky to earth. He didn't collect his saints from the four winds. This is where it's going to get weird for some of you. And I'm going to say this. How do you know that? Maybe you're misunderstanding what those actions actually are. And I've had a number of conversations over the years with premillennial people trying to explain my position to them and get to a place here in the text where it says, they say, as we read these things, they say, that's just not possible. But I believe it is an assumption that they are bringing to the text that makes it so. They are reading, for one thing, often, symbolic events as literal. Stars falling to earth, beasts coming out of the sea, a third of the rivers dried up, and they're picturing all of these things happening literally. Apocalypse, Armageddon, end of the world, fire, the world turning like this. Just think of how Hollywood often portrays this. It's like a giant Transformer Michael Bay movie, right? Everything just flipping upside down and but if you really want to see a picture in Hollywood of a world falling apart, of an end of the world, I would suggest don't go to Michael Bay. Go to Schindler's List. You'll see an end of a world. You'll see. You can't see apocalyptic things. That's why they are calypso, hidden. You have to read an apocalypse, a revelation, to see what is really going on during these times. On earth, it doesn't look exactly like this. Okay? That's what apocalypse means. Revelation, unveiling, pulling aside, okay, so that human eyes can see what the spiritual realities are behind that. Now, I don't need to mention this before. We read in our responsive reading that this language is not new to Jesus' prophecy here. In the Old Testament, the shifting and the blacking out and the falling of the sun, moon, and stars is a common symbol for the destruction of a great power. The defeat, the destruction of an ancient city. It refers to a cosmic upheaval, but not the end of the world, but the end of a world. And I believe that this does, even in the fall of Babylon, I believe that there are, if we're reading Daniel correctly, there were spiritual realities at work in all of those things, things which we can't see or understand. Okay? The way in which they are revealed to us is through this prophetic language of the sun, moon, and stars falling and not giving their light and so forth. But it is symbolic. It is a picture of the great harlot city, Jerusalem, being overthrown. The old world order being overthrown. The iron feet being smashed by the rock. Not literal changes to the sun, moon, and stars. But I would add that that doesn't mean that there weren't great signs in the sky. I believe there were. And I think we have good reason for believing that there were. Luke seems to be emphasizing more of those visible signs. And he writes this. There will be signs in the sun, moon, and stars, and on the earth, distress of nations and perplexity because of the roaring of the sea and the waves, people fainting with fear and with foreboding at what is coming in the world, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And this surely happened. For one thing, we don't believe it happened because we have external evidence confirming it, but we believe that it happened because Jesus said it would happen. So I believe it happened. I believe that there were amazing signs all around that people saw that told them this is a great cataclysmic cosmic event that is taking place right in front of us. Because that's what Jesus said would happen. But nevertheless, and we do not rest our faith on Tacitus, okay? He's not as reliable as Jesus. But he said this about the Jewish war and what happened. He said prodigies, that is what he means there, is not a great piano player, like Lang Lang. Okay, he means prodigies, these are unusual and amazing things that people saw, had occurred, which this nation, the Jews, prone to superstition, but hating all religious rites, did not deem it lawful to expiate by offering and sacrifice. Now, what he means there is that these simpleton Jews, they don't know the proper pagan ways of dealing with these things. So you see some great comet or something in the sky. You see this thing that happens. What you're supposed to do is go sacrifice a pig. And then it takes care of that. Okay, it's what he believes. These superstitious Jews don't do that, and that's why these things happen to them. That's his profound theological interpretation of what happened. But he goes on describing these prodigies. There had been seen great hosts joining battle in the skies, the fiery gleam of arms. The temple was illuminated by a sudden radiance from the clouds. The doors of the inner shrine were suddenly thrown open, and a voice of more than mortal tone, I like that, a voice of more than mortal tone, it should be a hymn, was heard to cry that the gods were departing. And at the same instant, there was a mighty stir as of departure. And what he means there is there's a great rushing wind blew through the temple. Now, we don't know what he saw or was reported to him that he saw or what these people actually saw, but it was widely known during that time that they had seen great signs in the sky. But we trust Jesus' testimony more than this. Now, we have to move on here. I'm aware. Bo wasn't kidding. I warned him. It's a big prophecy. There's a lot going on here. But Jesus makes this reference to the Son of Man. And that is a fairly clear reference to a number of things in Old Testament prophecy. And first of all, we note that in Daniel chapter 7, there is a reference to the Son of Man receiving a kingdom. As it says, "I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a Son of Man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him." Now notice, he comes with the clouds of heaven to the Ancient of Days. Okay? And there, a kingdom is given to him. Now, even among Christian interpreters, there's different understanding of what is going on there. But we just note that coming in the clouds of heaven in the Old Testament, the Son of Man, that refers to his ascension and session, okay? Refers to his being risen to power over the nations. "To him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one which shall not be destroyed." Now, I believe that Jesus is making reference to this in his prophecy here. And we note that the coming in Daniel 7 is his receiving of a kingdom. But as it says actually in the Greek, it's frequently translated. I'm just going to read it there. It's frequently translated this. It's not as helpful when it's translated this way, I think. It gives an impression that what you're going to see is something different. It says this in the ESV and in many translations. "Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they see the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven with power and glory." But actually what it says is, "Then will appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven." It's probably a reference there to Daniel chapter 7. That prophecy that we understand in Daniel 7, that's going to actually take place in heaven. Now that Jesus is making, I'm actually going to skip ahead here. So there is a spectrum of preterist interpreters here. Okay, and this is one problem. If you pick up Ken Gentry on this, or James Jordan, or Peter Lighthart on this section of Scripture, they're all going to believe that this is speaking of something that happened in the first century. But regarding these specific verses here, they actually, all three, have a different take on this. And that just goes to show you that I believe that they are largely right in terms of their understanding of this whole chapter and what is basically going on here. But when it comes to the particulars, well, we're still trying to understand that and come to a better understanding of it. There's a spectrum in terms of this. There are those who see in these things, it is purely apocalyptic language that is fulfilled in purely human events that take place. You would not even know that there were spiritual realities going on down here on earth. And there are those who believe that there were actually great cosmic things that were seen even there in AD 70. I believe that, as I mentioned before, there were great signs and things that were seen. There were a great deliverance of God's people that took place during this time. And there were many saints that were ushered up into heaven to rule the nations with a rod of iron with Christ. I believe that. This all happened in that sign. All of these are orthodox and they fit well within our confession of faith, and which simply says that at the end of days, Jesus is coming back. He will raise all the remaining dead. There will be a great judgment of all people, and we will enter what we call the eternal state. That's what our confession says, okay? And we confess that every single week, okay? This is not contradicting that. There are a handful of those on that spectrum that go so far as to say that every prophecy, and I've mentioned these guys before, they take all of these prophecies and they say it all was fulfilled in AD 70. That's called hyperpreterism, and it leads you into some very, very strange beliefs about what we actually are right now, what the resurrection actually is. It just that once the dominoes in that sense start to fall, it leads you into all kinds of strange places. That teaching should be rejected as unorthodox, contrary to our confessions, and heretical. Well, that's not what we're saying here. Okay? So, I just have a few minutes left, and I think I'm going to end with just a charge. We're going to have a lot of time to develop these things from Revelation. There is a lot that was transformed during this time. The one who did these things was Jesus. And he is powerful to do them. And some people will say, well, if he came back then, will he come back in exactly the same way again? And I believe the answer to that is complex. What changed in AD 70 was profound, never to be repeated again. Once we have entered into this age, which the scripture calls the regeneration, okay? Once we've entered into this age, we don't go back. We don't look for another temple building to be built again and sacrifices to be offered. Once the substance has come, the shadows are done away with. The old world order was done away with, and we now live in this new world order. The heavens are turned upside down. You have in heaven now a man, a son of man, a second Adam, ruling along with his human saints. This would have been unthinkable. If you had said this 100 years before Christ, that this is what is going to happen, angels will serve an order of men and women and children in heaven, and they will rule with Christ. Who would have thought that was the most mad thing you could possibly believe, but that is exactly what Christ has done. It is exactly what he has done. So in a sense, no, this won't happen again. But as I mentioned at the beginning of this sermon, yes. Yes, it happens many times that Christ comes, that he summons angels, armies, raises up powers, earthquakes. He rules the nations. He is producing a great work, as it says in 1 Corinthians 15, all of his enemies are being subject to him. He is defeating his enemies, and the last enemy is death. And when all his enemies are defeated, he hands back the kingdom to the Father. That is his great work. He continues to work. He doesn't go back up into heaven, sit down, and do nothing. He rules and reigns and will until the end of time. Now, there are many things. How do we live in a very, very turbulent and troubled time? Many, many Christian teachers are teaching right now that we're in somewhere between seal, like 4 and 5, like you can, you know, or maybe they're looking at these things and saying, look around at our world. What do we do living? I also believe that we are living at the end of a world. I believe that is the only way that human history goes forward and up. Is when old things die and Christ resurrects them better than they were before. I believe that human history is moved forward by the blood of the martyrs and their testimony. That is the way this becomes a template. Revelation becomes a template for what Christ does throughout human history and how he moves things forward and shakes them free and builds and constructs and brings life to the world. And so what we are looking at in our world now and grieving, we have a choice as to how to think about it and how to respond. We can choose to kind of hide ourselves, to withdraw, to store up toilet paper, do whatever we need to do to take care of ourselves. That is not what the saints in the first century did. It was a time for them of action and witness and power and testimony and deeds of kindness and charity. And I would have you know that what we are looking at right now, this has been a very turbulent 20 years. And we could probably even just like the last 5 years. Turbulent. The world is in this unfolding chaos. Peter Lighthart says this, and I want you to think about this in closing. The 20th century was the great century of martyrdom in Christian history. One historian estimated that 2/3 of the 70 million estimated Christian martyrs throughout church history, that 2/3 of them were killed after 1900. He estimates that 45 million people have been killed during that time, mostly by communists and Muslims. There is a more conservative historical estimate that places it around 25 million. Now listen to this. This is how he ends his essay. Do you think that their blood is unrelated to the global shaking that is taking place, started in around 2001? I want to read that again because I butchered it. Do you think that their blood is unrelated to the global shaking that began in 2001? And how does that make you think about what is happening around you? Are you worried that Christ is off his throne? The shaking of things is a sign that he is on his throne. And he is moving forward with his plan of glory. And he always comes to honor his beloved bride when she's mistreated, and to protect and to defend her. Nothing moves history along like the faithful witness of God's people, the strong arm of Christ that comes down to defend his faithful bride. And if we would see Christ continue to move in history, then we must also be faithful to the end. Amen? Amen. Soli Deo Gloria. May God be glorified in the preaching of his good word.